Okay, let's start with this one here, maybe here. Venerable Sir, a lot of primitive practices of black magic and sorcery, as well as counter practices for blessings, are practiced by many people, including Buddhist monks in Sri Lanka. But according to my understanding of the Buddha's word, it is only our karma, thoughts and actions in this and past life, that affect us. It would not be in keeping with Buddhism if some other individual can affect you through evil, counter evil practices. What is your opinion? To put it simply, how can black magic even fit in to Buddhist philosophy? It can perhaps fit in, because it could be your bad karma that someone puts black magic on you. Yeah, conceivably. But I don't think karma really works like that, to be honest. For me, karma is a big picture thing. Karma is about why you get reborn in a particular realm, not so much the things that happen to you within that realm. If you are reborn as a human being, then certain things you can expect. You can expect a certain amount of suffering in your life. Very often as a Buddhist monk, you are asked, oh, why did this happen to me? What did I do in the past to deserve this? My husband, my wife has just left me. I lost my job. My children is kind of misbehaving. Oh, what karma did I do in the past? Actually, the karma was the karma to become human, because that's what happens when you become human. Your wife leaves you. Yeah, you lose your job. But this is a kind of natural in the human realm. This happens to so many people. Nothing has gone wrong, nothing to do with karma. The mistake was getting reborn as a human. That was the mistake. So it's your fault. No. No, it's not nobody's fault. It's just conditioning. Yeah, you get reborn as a human being. Yeah. So black magic, does it work? Well, to be honest with you, maybe there is such a thing as black magic. I don't really know. I've never really encountered black magic in my life. And I think it is highly overrated. I think a lot of it is a psychological manipulation. You manipulate people, and then when they really believe it, they feel as if the black magic is working, yeah, because they are convinced it works or whatever. I think a lot of psychological trickery is a very important part of this black magic thing. Is it possible to do black magic beyond psychological trickery? To be honest with you, I don't know. But I prefer to remain skeptical about these things. There's many things that you can do that are outside of the ordinary realm, but whether this is one of those, I don't really know. But remember that the people who do black magic, they are certainly making a lot of bad karma for themselves. Because they are hurting other people through, even if their black magic doesn't work, they still have bad intention. So they're still making bad karma. Yeah, so for them, it is really, really bad news. So anyone who is doing black magic, they're not really acting according to Buddhist ideas at all. And if they want to kind of have a good life, they should stop pretty quickly. Do we have any black magic professionals in here? We'd be interested in hearing from you. Anyone who does black magic? No one does black magic. Okay. See, I told you that isn't that many. Yeah. So it's kind of you. It's always a bit of a waste of time. It's very rare to meet these kind of people. So I wouldn't be too concerned. If kind of half the audience raised their hands, then we would have a problem. Maybe we should invite some black magic professionals, Bante. I think that's a good idea. Next conference, and we can have some shows how they do and that kind of thing. That would be interesting. See if it works. We have some volunteer who comes up, and then we kind of try it out. So it actually is not a bad idea, because sometimes you need to dispel some of these myths. And when you actually see them, either it becomes true, either you get it confirmed or you get it dispelled. It can be quite useful. Anyway, getting a bit sidetracked as usual. So does it fit into Buddhist philosophy? I don't think it goes against Buddhist philosophy, but I wonder whether it goes against just the reality of how the universe works instead. Anyway, next question. How do children who have been abused by their parents, for instance, ever heal their childhood wounds without going through the process of grieving, including expressions of anger? How does Buddhism help here? The rationalization is that the karma seems a cruel explanation to a child. Also, in such a case, the God's love preached by born again is often an attraction amongst abused children I've seen. because it makes up for the love that is missing in their life. How can Buddhism help then when the monks they are access to cannot provide compassion? I think the monks should really provide some compassion for people who are suffering. That's kind of what Buddhism is about, in my opinion. And the idea that you rationalize this by saying that it is the karma from the past to cause this is really not the right way of thinking about the Buddhist teachings. It's a misunderstanding of what these things are about. We all potentially have this kind of possibility inside of us. You get born as a human being, there is a potential for getting abused. That is what it means to be born as a human being. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean it's got anything to do with bad karma. But even if it does have something to do with bad karma, it is quite likely that each one of us has those seeds of bad karma inside of us that can then ripen in some future life, if not in this life. So we should never judge another person on this basis, because we are no different. Just because someone happens to be in that position doesn't mean that we are not susceptible to the same problem down the line. So this is really a very bad way of thinking about Buddhism, and it shouldn't undermine the compassion at all. In fact, on the contrary, because we should understand that this is the nature of being a being in this universe, the nature of being humans, that we are all under the influence of this terrible kind of conditioning, such as abuse. It is true for each one of us. We have all been there, and we probably all will go there in the future, unless we make an end of samsaric existence altogether. So once you see it in the big picture of things, we're all the same again. And then you cannot really say that it is this person's problem. Yeah, it is your problem because you did bad. Actually, we're all in the same boat. And because we're all conditioned by these external forces, ultimately, we are not responsible for this kind of suffering. All we do is suffer, sometimes not understanding why it is. And this is the tragic of samsara, of samsaric existence. So compassion is always right. Yeah, when people suffer, of course we should be compassionate, regardless of what it is. There's no such thing as suffering that is your fault and suffering that is someone else's fault. All suffering is the samsara working out in a certain way. All suffering is equally worthy of compassion, regardless of what it is. Even if a robber comes and, you know, some of it seems like to be external, other things look like they are self imposed, but actually it is the same kind of suffering from a more ultimate perspective, because it's just cause and conditions. When there is no self, when there is no internal agent that is responsible for these things, the only responsibility falls on cause and conditions, whether they are internal or external. So we should absolutely be compassionate, have compassion. And the born again is often an attraction among abused children because it makes up for the love that is missing in their lives. Well, the real love to develop is the inner love, which we can all develop in our own hearts. The external love of God depends on that being a reality. What if it isn't? What if you're believing in a fantasy, in a phantom? I don't believe in a Christian, permanent Christian God myself. I don't think there is such a reality. To me, it doesn't make any sense at all. And because of that, you may believe in it, you may use it as some kind of a thing to help you get through a difficult time, but what if the God isn't there? Ultimately, you're going to be let down if the God isn't there. So really, the only solution is, even for a child that has been abused, is to develop that love in your own heart. That is the right place to develop these qualities. So how can you do that as a child that has been abused? And the way to do that is to use the kind of techniques I've been talking about tonight. You have to learn how to understand that even those people who abused you, who gave you a hard time, ultimately they were conditioned, they were deluded, they didn't know what they were doing. They were also running along cause and conditions. It's the tragedy of samsara that people get abused. It is not the tragedy of a particular relationship or a particular person being at fault. It is a much bigger picture thing. So the child, you start to reflect, you start to think that actually these people who abused me, maybe your parents even abused you, yeah, in certain cases. Actually, my parents didn't have much choice. They may have been abused in turn by their parents or by someone else. And then they get really confused and really uncertain and really deluded about that. And then they carry out the same abuse again on the next generation. And so it goes on and on and on down the line. There's always cause and conditions. And if you fully understand the cause and conditions, you can forgive anyone. And that is true even of an abused child. Of course, it's very hard to forgive someone who has really done something terribly bad towards you. But you can forgive that process. You can start that process of forgiveness, at least a little bit, by starting to think about the world in the right way. And whether you can take it all the way to the end by forgiving completely, maybe you can't, maybe you can, depending on the circumstance. But you can always go some way towards that. If you have to grieve on the way, if you have to get a bit angry on the way, all right, so be it. That's okay. It is not, in these kind of difficult situations, you know, we can accept that people get a bit angry and they grieve. That's fine, as long as you're moving in the right direction, heading out of it and moving on to a better life on the other side. So it can be done. You just have to use these powerful teachings of the Buddha in the right way. And then when you do them in the right way, they have the power to heal the most deepest wounds in human beings. So, and I think also monks should absolutely, they should have compassion in these kind of situations, yeah? And otherwise it is a kind of, and maybe that's why we need more nuns. Maybe nuns have more compassion than monks. Is that right? Are there any nuns here? No nuns here. It's good. I think it's nice. One of the things that I really like about Sri Lanka is that you have quite a strong bhikkhuni order here now, bhikkhunis and bhikkhus. And I think it's very useful to have that balance between male and female, not only upasakas and upasikas, but also in the monastic order itself. Because bhikkhunis can often fill roles in society that may not be so easy for bhikkhus to fulfill. In part, that would be, it may be easier if you are a woman to talk to a bhikkhuni than a bhikkhu about certain things, yeah? So actually, I think they can fulfill, there can be a nice balance there if we have both sides of the monastic order, not only one side. So maybe that is one of the solutions. So maybe take this person, if the monks weren't kind to this person, take this person to a bhikkhuni instead and see what happens. Maybe that would be better. Don't know. Check it out. Okay, next question. Practice of Buddhism thrived in Sri Lanka during the agro-economic days. What should be our approach to the practice in modern times? It should be basically the same. The practice doesn't really change just because the economic circumstances and the technology and all of these things change. The practice is still roughly the same. What is that practice? And I've been telling people this now many times. You can summarize the entire Buddhist practice, if you like, in one single word. And that single word is kindness. If you take kindness all the way, if you understand it fully, all the dimensions of kindness, including speech, actions, and also thought, and even perceptions, if you understand it fully, it is a very, very comprehensive ethical path. And if you do it, if you commit to that, persevere with that over a long period of time, the changes inside of you will be very profound and very important. And what you will find is that when you even try to do some meditation later on, what you will find is that your meditation becomes so easy because your ethics and your moral conduct has been going so well for such a long time. So this is really the holy grail of, to use a Christian term, the holy grail of, of Buddhist practice. Kindness is really where it is at. So please be as kind as you possibly can. And if you can do that, you are basically fulfilling the practice. And that is as true now as it was in the agricultural period of Sri Lanka. It is basically the same thing. These days, you have to be a bit more careful not to be kind of hijacked by the internet and by Facebook and by who knows what. I was going to say God knows what, but God doesn't know what at all. He hasn't got a clue what's going on. Poor God, we kind of put this on the shoulders of God, and he can't take any blame for that. So all of these things. Sometimes we have to be a bit more wise to avoid all the temptations that are out there. We have to know when to put aside our smartphone, lock it up into a safe. We can't access. Somebody else has the code, and they will only tell you the code the next morning or something like that. Sometimes we have to use tricks to avoid accessing our devices so we can actually have a bit of peace and we can sleep properly at night and these kind of things. So that is really where the challenge is. Okay, next question. In the Dhammapada, it is said that the path to profit and path to Nibbana are opposite. Then how can we integrate Buddha's teachings in the world of commerce? I can't remember the saying now. What is that saying? Does anyone know that saying exactly? Is that exactly how it goes? I think, I'm not sure what this actually says. I don't think they necessarily are opposites at all. If I had remembered the line, I can't remember the line, I might have been able to talk about it more clearly. But my suspicion is that what it says is that if you are focused entirely on profit, in other words, that's what I said before, you're focused entirely on the results, on what you want to achieve, without thinking about the process in between, then you have a problem. Because if you're focusing entirely on the result, it means you will take shortcuts on the way, you're going to live immorally as a consequence, and that is why it is the path opposed to Nibbana, and that is why they go in different directions. But not profit as such. If you live well and you happen to get profit just as the outcome of living well, of course, there is no problem with that at all. So it depends, here I would say it depends on the context, and it's not enough context here to really be able to tell. But that would be my guess on that one. Those are the questions. Do we have any more questions from the floor perhaps, or from anyone would like to say anything here?
If you have any questions, I can bring the mic to you. Anybody wants to go?
I promise to answer politely, regardless of what you say, so please don't be afraid.
Venerable sir, it'll be very nice to see what the reaction was to your university talk there about equal people and things like that. What was the Western reaction? Because it's not in the East.
Yes, yeah. The reaction was actually very positive. And I think what they thought and what they told me, because they had lecturers coming in from all the various religions, they had Catholics coming in, they had Muslim coming in, they had, I think, the Hindu coming in, all the things. And I think they all recognized that actually Buddhism had much more to offer than any of the other religions. Which is exactly what I, you know, which I would tend to agree with, because Buddhism has a very comprehensive philosophy of the mind, comprehensive philosophy of the practice, of the path, and all of these kind of things. So it was, generally speaking, a very, very positive response to these things. Yeah, people could relate to it. Rebirth, a little bit more difficult, but the general principles, indeed. Yeah. Okay, you don't want to ask anything? Are you sure? Okay, there we have one over there. Don't be shy. If you think that your question is stupid, no question is stupid. Yeah, and stupid questions are usually the best ones, so go for it. Yes, please.
This question really was posed to me by a taxi driver. Talking about why I was coming here today. And his question was, would it not be very good if all of us can spend 1 year as a Buddhist monk in our lives and then get back to our normal lives? Will that make us better people? Your thoughts.
Okay. I would say there is no need to. I think spending a year at a Buddhist monastery might be nice, yeah, coming to a Buddhist monastery or some retreat center or something like that and spend a year seriously practicing the Buddhist teachings. You don't have to ordain to do that. You can stay in white, take the 8 precepts, that's plenty good enough. You are virtually a monastic if you wear white and you keep the 8 precepts. You're so close to the monastic path. And especially if you take the 10 precepts, you're very, very close to being a fully ordained person. That is what matters, and that I would agree with, to have a period of time when you can really go into the teachings to understand what they are. Because in lay life, it is difficult to find enough time to fully understand the Buddhist philosophy and the Buddhist outlook and the path of practice and all of these things. But you don't really have to ordain. And I think this is one of the things that I don't really agree so much with, this tradition of temporary ordination that you find in certain places. Because the idea of ordaining is to have a more long-term commitment. If you know you're going to disrobe down the track, it's going to be very disruptive for your ability to practice. So just come as a layperson instead. But the general principle, I think, is a very good one. Would you like to come to a monastery? Maybe we can find a place for you. Let us know. Thank you.
Thank you, Bhante, for that talk. I just wanted to get back to the right view of anatma and the idea of non-self. Like, I can wrap my head around the idea of a non-psychic self, like the subject is ever passing and changing, not attached to our past, and the events that come into anything we remember is something that we experience in the present. So we, as observers of our experience, how do we reconcile the physical nature of the body and the fact that we have to take care of our body, which in a sense houses our experience of life and the experience of non-self? So we have to take care of the body that experiences the idea of non-self.
So you're asking, how do we understand the experiencer as non-self? Is that what you're asking?
No, I'm asking how do we reconcile the fact that we have to take care of the body to experience non-self?
Okay, so how do we reconcile that we have to take care of the body to experience non-self? Sorry,
because maybe an unhealthy person would find it very difficult to practice mindfulness.
It's
a precept of having a healthy body in order to foster a healthy mind.
Sure. Okay, yeah, no, I think that is quite compatible, those two ideas. The idea is that you have to practice a certain path to be able to experience these things. Yeah, you have to kind of go in a certain direction. There are certain mental qualities you have to build up. And without those qualities inside, basically it is impossible to build it up. And having a healthy body so that you can, you know, you can do the necessary practices. And the thing is that if you get really sick, your mind gets clouded, you get deluded, you have no mind, you lose your mindfulness. Those mental qualities are affected by your physical body. And that is why you need to look after the physical body in order to kind of develop the good mental qualities. It ultimately comes down to mental qualities. But there is a, you know, in many ways, there is a much more profound conundrum there than that one. And that one of the conundrums is there is a place in the suttas where it is said that you need a certain type of desire to kind of make practice on the path. And then it is said, well, actually, the end of the path is the end of desire. So you need desire to make an end of desire. How does that make sense? That is even more difficult to explain, maybe, yes? But the idea is that you need a certain inclination of the mind. You need a certain starting point. And that starting point drives you to the point whereby you get that particular insight that enables you to give up the craving. So you need something, like you need to, you know, to come here today. I needed the desire to come here. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sitting here if I didn't have that desire. Everything needs some driving force behind these things. So the same thing is true with attachment. You need some attachment to be able to move you towards no attachment. And that attachment is, you need to have a bit of attachment to kindness, to morality. That attachment to kindness and morality will ultimately lead you to no attachment down the line. So everything in Buddhism is like relative, depending on where you're standing and what point you're looking at it from. This, I may not come back to Sri Lanka for a long time. This is your chance to, I don't know. There we have one. Okay, good. That's a good question. And I think this is one of the traps of many people in the world. When you look at people who are wealthy, it looks like somehow this is really valuable. But what they should do, tell them to come to me and I will tell them. And I have met so many wealthy people, a lot of wealthy people in my life. I have met them in my monastic life, but also before that. And one of the things that I can say with absolute certainty, it makes virtually no difference whether you're poor or wealthy in terms of your levels of happiness, in terms of the kind of problems you have and all of these things. Wealthy people have exactly the same problems as poor people. My children aren't behaving properly, doing the wrong thing. My child has become a Christian. I wanted to be a Buddhist and becoming a Christian. What did I do? What did I do wrong? They have no gratitude for all the things I did for them. Blah, 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 blah. On and on it goes. And I know this because often they will invite me. I will sit there for breakfast. They say, oh yeah, please come down and have breakfast with us. And as soon as you sit down at the table, they start telling you all their problems. Yeah. There's no such thing as a free lunch. You know that saying? There's no free breakfast. So I think you need to have a certain wisdom about you. And I think that is often the problem. But there is this idea in our mind, there's a very powerful idea, that if you become wealthy, if you get everything right, it will somehow be glorious. It's not. It's exactly, pretty much exactly the same. The difference is so minute. So you just have to... I suppose you just have to investigate carefully. You have to look carefully, not just look superficially. And then hopefully you were able to break through that spell, the idea that somehow wealth is going to make a big difference. In some ways it is quite obvious if you think about it carefully, because the problem of dissatisfaction, the problem of not being content in life, is a psychological problem. It's something inside. And you will never be able to satisfy that inner psychological problem or get rid of it by external means. This is what we always try. We always try to fill up this hole inside of us, sense of not being complete, not being content, not being fully happy. We try to fill it up through the five senses, through relationships, through material well-being and all of these things. But it can't work, because actually it is a psychological problem at root. That's why we're not happy, not content. The only way to change that and to find true contentment is to develop your mind instead. Then you are going to the source of the problem. Then craving stops, because once you fill yourself up with good feelings from your good actions, from living well, from meditation, even from wisdom, eventually you fill up you build up so much goodness inside, craving stops automatically. This is what happens in samadhi meditation. You build up all of these positive feelings, craving is completely gone, and you have found the answer to the meaning of life. And a bit of insight, and bang, you're finished with the whole path. So a little bit of reflection like that, I think, will convince somebody. Are you poor or rich? Are you, you get by, you're okay, good, okay. You don't have to answer these questions. I'm just being cheeky, you know. So very good. Okay, yes, please.
Venerable Brahmali, I have a very personal question.
Yeah, okay.
I'm a little nervous asking this in a public forum as well. But the more I read about our impact on the environment, and the more I read about mankind and my own experience in this world, yeah, I have a continuous feeling that I personally don't want to have children and bring them into this cycle. Yeah. But it's a constant debate. Is that a right view for me to approach this question that I have?
I wouldn't say it's neither right nor wrong. It's just a personal decision. Yeah, it's not necessarily. It depends on what you want to do with your life. If you want to live your life, if you want to become a Buddhist nun, definitely I wouldn't encourage you to have children. That should be probably the last thing you should do. If you want to become a nun, or you want to live a more spiritual kind of life, there's nothing wrong with not having children. Sometimes there's so much pressure in the world for people to have children and raise up the next generation. I don't think there should be any kind of that pressure. There should be a purely personal decision if we want to have children or not. There should be no obligation in that area. So I don't think you should feel obliged. You should do what feels right for you. And if you prefer to pursue a more spiritual kind of life or whatever it is, please do so. But the idea of not bringing children into the world because the children will suffer. Well, remember, what brings a child into the world is not you. It is the craving in the child that brings them into the world. They will get reborn regardless of whether you have that child or not. So one thing you could say is that if you are a good person and you practice and you kind of can help someone to look at the world in a good way and help them out in one way, maybe a child will be very grateful to have a mother like yourself. Yeah, maybe that would be a good thing because you can help them on the right track. You can give them some values by which they can negotiate the difficulties in this world. And that is kind of the positive side of things. So it's not going to make a difference for that child whether you know, they're still going to get reborn somehow. They can't get out of that. It's more a personal question for yourself, how you want to lead your life. That is really where you should take your stand. But either way, if you want to have children or you don't, there should be no stigma or no kind of, society shouldn't tell you what is right. Perfectly okay not to have children. I've heard so many cases of women saying that there's a pressure to have children. And I think I don't think that is correct because it's perfectly possible to live a very satisfied and complete life without having children in this world. Anyway, are you okay with that? Yeah, okay.
Venerable sir, I have a question, sort of a contradiction. I was thinking about the concept of anatta. So if you take across births, how do we relate anatta across births? Because is it always like a 1:1 relationship between one life and the next? Or if you take it in that way, if you consider, say, multiple lives of a person, do you take that as one? Or is it like one can be one to many sort of things?
It's one to one.
It's always one to one.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. This is in the word of the Buddha. It's called the stream of consciousness. The stream of consciousness which goes across from one life to the next one is one stream. It's one stream which has a certain karmic potential to it. And that's why what you do in one life affects the next life. Otherwise, it becomes very complicated and very possible to work out. So it is like one stream. But that stream is always changing. That stream is not constant. It's like a river. The molecules are always changing in that river. So there's a certain continuity. The shape of the river stays the same. Yeah, if you imagine a river, the shape is roughly the same all the time, or it takes long periods of time, like the seasons varying, the rain with the rainfall or whatever, the shape changes. But the actual molecules of the water, they are changing all the time. The stream of consciousness is a bit like that. Your personal traits will remain the same for long periods of time. That's why you can recognize yourself in the past life. But the actual consciousness is changing much, very, very fast and very rapidly.
Reverend sir, in certain instances, when you really want to put people on the right path, we have identified that story-based learning is a very powerful way to use. In the process of creating a story, if you fabricate something, maybe is it a violation of the fourth precept?
If you fabricate a story, is it a violation of the fourth precept? Not if you are honest about it. If you say this is a true story, when it's fabricated, then it's a violation of the fourth precept. But usually people know if it's fabricated or not. You don't even have to tell them. As long as you're not pretending that it is real when in fact it's fabricated, there's no issue there. Please fabricate. It's good. Sometimes we need a few fabrications as well, yeah? Make things a bit more interesting, yeah. Okay. Can we fabricate one more question, maybe? Yeah? Because it was so quick.
This was meant to be a talk for business. Have you got any advice on how a businessman progresses without being greedy?
How a businessman progresses without being greedy? It's a matter of values. And it's a matter of changing your values and having the right priorities in your life, remembering what really matters. And this is why this idea of long-term investment is so important. Because once you look at things from a long-term perspective, that actually does change your values. You start to look at the world in a different way, and it impacts on your inner life. And you may still be greedy, but now you're greedy for good karma instead of... But that is okay kind of greed. We have to start somewhere. And if you are greedy about being kind, already you are on the right track. Gradually, that will actually cause the greed to go down, because you cannot really be greedy about being kind in the long run. After a while, you start to see the absurdity of the situation, and it kind of let go of the greed as a consequence. So it's all about this value thing, and values come out of how we look at the world. And this is why the idea of rebirth is so important, because precisely it changes your values, your priorities, what is important to you, and how you live for the long term instead of the short term. So that is what I would say. So that is at least one way of looking at that question. Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't know how to use mobile phones.
If you listen to talks given by monks in different traditions, for example, Thai tradition, then does that mean we will get conditioned in that way?
Yes, that's exactly what it means. So whatever you listen to, whatever you take on board, you will be conditioned accordingly. So if you listen to Thai monks, you might end up speaking Thai here. Maybe you get reborn in Thailand next time around, yeah? So because you like those talks and you speak Thai as a consequence. But yes, of course, you will be conditioned. So if you listen to Thai monks and they give a different kind of teaching, then gradually you will kind of at least move a little bit in that direction. But actually, it's not a bad thing, yeah? Because sometimes when you listen to talk outside of your own tradition, it opens up your mind to new possibilities and new ways of looking. And that can be very useful. We tend to be too constricted sometimes into our own little tiny tradition, and sometimes that can constrict us from seeing the larger truth in many things. I think it's a good thing to sometimes take a step back and look at the broader picture. There's many very interesting studies in Buddhism that have come out of that kind of approach. Things such as comparative study across various traditions. And this is even going back all the way back to the time of the Buddha and looking at the historical evolution of Buddhism, how Theravada came out of this, how the other schools came out of this, and then comparing all of these things. And when you understand Buddhist history properly, you also start to understand whether the suttas that we have today, for example, are the authentic word of the Buddha and that kind of thing. And these things are very useful because they give rise to a sort of solid confidence that we have the real deal. If you just go by tradition, sometimes you may not know whether what we have really is the word of the Buddha or what it is. So sometimes expanding your mind out can be very useful. So do listen to some Thai monks. Make sure they are good Thai monks, though. Don't choose the dodgy ones. Whenever you listen to Dhamma, make sure you are careful with what you listen to. There is so much weird stuff going on in the world of Dhamma. Make sure you are very discerning about what you listen to. Otherwise, you're going to be taken for a ride and you're getting all kind of crazy ideas about Buddhism. So be very, very careful. Generally speaking, instead of latching on to some newfangled idea that somebody has, instead of doing that, stick to the tradition. Yeah, generally speaking, usually the tradition is more reliable than all the newfangled ideas coming out.
Okay, there's another question online. What is correct Buddhism, Theravada or Mahayana?
Oh, they're both wrong. Yeah, that's what I say. Yeah. It is the correct Buddhism is the Dhamma of the Buddha. That is the correct Buddhism, and neither if. Depends what we mean by Theravada. Theravada, do we mean the word of the Buddha, or do we mean the way people practice today? And if we mean what the people practice today, it is not the same as the word of the Buddha. So Theravada today means all kind of additional teachings, yeah? And this is what we mean by Theravada. And that is not really the earliest kind of Buddhism. If you look at Mahayana, similar kind of picture. They may have gone even further, really, really astray sometimes, but similar kind of problem. Some of the teachings they have are early Buddhist teachings, but many of them are later things. So we should be careful with trying to kind of divide too much between the various kinds of Buddhism. Instead, try to understand what is the word of the Buddha, and that is what we should stick to. And it's quite easy, really. The word of the Buddha is really the Pali tradition is the four main Nikayas, yeah? Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, four main Nikayas. That's where the word of the Buddha is. Mahayana tradition also have some of those suttas, and sometimes they are used in the Mahayana tradition. Theravada tradition, we definitely have them, but often people don't focus on them, they focus on other things instead. So what we should ideally do, try to come back to the word of the Buddha. That would be my suggestion.
Okay, we will pass the mic on for the last question.
Bhante, this is just something I'm just trying to reconcile. So you spoke about kindness and integrating kindness to every aspect of your life in terms of speech, action, intention. But what if what you speak may not be conventionally considered kindness because convention is determined by the culture and the society you live in and the norms? Is in that sense considered mean, but actually the intention is kindness? So how do you sort of reconcile that?
Reconcile that, yeah. Well, in the end, from a spiritual point of view, it is your intention that is important, yeah, not what society tells you is right. And sometimes society does get it wrong. All societies have their own biases and slants and things. So, but sometimes you have to compromise a little bit, because if you, you know, if you do things that go too much against the social norm, you end up becoming an outcast, and that's also not so nice. So make sure your intention is right, but sometimes you can kind of juggle it a little bit so that you kind of meet both criteria. Usually you should be able to meet both criteria as long as you are kind of wise and smart about it. Okay, very good.
Okay, with that, we conclude this session. And before we finish, maybe invite the Venerable Monks here to do a little short chanting, blessing Venerable Ajahn Brahmali and, of course, all of us and the country.
Sukham balam